There has been a video emerge, believed to be the gunman who live streamed this horrendous attack
Facebook.
Though, that's
the attack
full
was designed
hatred.
To get maximum coverage. Sorry, yeah. Teased
and
on
it's believed
Twitter.
That he is the one who live streamed himself opening fire.
New Zealand mosque shootings live streamed a video of the attack for 17 minutes. It was streaming.
Enabled
and
by and tailored for.
He posted these pictures of magazines for automatic weapons on his website 3 days ago. With the names of right-wing terrorists.
Welcome to the Countercurrents podcast series. I'm Martin Cocker, founder of the Online Safety Exchange and host of the OSX Network for Online Safety Practitioners. In March 2019, I was the CEO of NetSafe Aotearoa, New Zealand's primary online support service, and like many in the online safety field at that time, extremism and terrorism weren't front of mind for me. That is, until the afternoon of March 15th. Information about the online aspects of the Christchurch terror attacks flowed in very quickly. There was a live stream, and there was a manifesto. A video from the live stream began circulating widely on social media. The phones ran hot, and safety teams, government agencies, law enforcement, and NGOs scrambled to respond. But there was no playbook and no response plan, and truthfully, it was chaotic. Every available resource was mobilised and every safety lever that could be pulled was pulled, but by the end of the day it was clear that the systems designed to prevent the distribution of this sort of harmful content online had failed. In the aftermath, I committed to deepening my understanding of how information technology is exploited to promote extremism, recruit followers and radicalise people towards violence. We know that the Christchurch attacker engaged with extremist content online and his radicalization journey was energized by that content. And we know that he contributed to those communities and posted of his intent to commit violence. A Royal Commission of Inquiry into the attacks analyzed what New Zealand's state sector agencies knew, did, and could have done to prevent the attacks, which can be found at christchurchattack.royalcommission.nz. The focus of this podcast series is the online aspects of violent extremism and terrorism and the currents of radicalization that flow through the internet. These are the currents that push the Christchurch attacker towards violence and that his livestream and manifesto have further energised. They look at the efforts and opportunities to counter those currents and how we can make it significantly harder for these groups to exploit technology, harder to recruit, harder to radicalise and harder to promote acts of violence. This episode, Balancing Act, is the third of four. In it we explore how we preserve essential freedoms whilst combating extremism online. Episode 1, Unprecedented, examined the online aspects of the Christchurch terror attacks, looking at the safety systems that were in place and some significant changes made since that tragic day. Episode 2, Mobilised, explored how technology is exploited by extremists and the responses to these challenges. And Episode 4, Except by Chance, investigates the warning signs of radicalisation and what people can do when they spot them. Before we begin this episode, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the 51 Shuhada, their families, the survivors and the witnesses of the Christchurch terror attacks, and indeed to acknowledge the victims of extremism and terrorism across the world. Whilst it's important that we analyse and learn from these events, I recognise that for many, these discussions represent lived experiences, not theoretical scenarios. In this episode of the Countercurrents podcast series, we're looking at the balancing act of setting rules and empowering agencies to act against extremism, whilst at the same time protecting users' rights and freedoms. This is a complex challenge where overly aggressive content moderation and enforcement risks infringing on legitimate speech, privacy and other freedoms, whilst insufficient action leaves dangerous extremist content and activity unchecked. The stakes are particularly high in areas like encryption, where tools that protect legitimate privacy rights can also shield criminal activity, and in automated content detection, where systems might flag and remove legitimate religious or political discourse. The stakes are particularly high when we're talking about empowering agencies to conduct secret surveillance and investigations.
My role is to look at two aspects of that, I suppose, and one is that they are lawfully and properly sharing the intelligence that they have, and when they are conducting their own activities, are they doing that in a necessary and proportionate way?
Brendan Horsley is New Zealand's Inspector General of Intelligence and Security Services and provides independent oversight of the two core intelligence agencies, the Security Intelligence Service and the Government Communications Security Bureau. His office is one of a number of agencies that have formal oversight roles in New Zealand.
The Ombudsman's the obvious one. With police, it's the Independent Police Conduct Authority. There's the Privacy Commissioner, Human Rights Commissioner. And they're probably the primary other oversight bodies. And I meet regularly with the Auditor General, IPCA, and who was the other one that I just mentioned? And the Ombudsman. Yeah, thank you. So I meet regularly, sort of quarterly, with those agencies and the Privacy Commissioner. And we talk about some sort of common issues that we might have around things like, could be anything from Official Information Act requests right through to where are our privacy concerns about online surveillance or those sorts of matters.
But much of what is allowed or not allowed to happen on the internet is not controlled by government agencies with defining legislation and statutorily appointed oversight. It's decided by moderation teams and often by preset moderation systems within tech companies. A key debate in content moderation centres on the extent to which private technology companies are bound by human rights frameworks. On one side is the argument that these platforms have become so fundamental to public discourse that they should be required to protect and promote established rights like freedom of expression, just as governments must. This view holds that when private companies control spaces that function as our modern public square, they inherit special responsibilities beyond those of a typical business. The counter-argument is that platforms are private companies and should maintain their right to set community standards as they see fit. Just as a shopping mall can prohibit certain behaviours on its property, platforms should be free to create rules that reflect their values and business goals, even if these rules are more restrictive than what governments might impose. Supporters of this view argue that platform diversity is healthy. Different services can set different standards, allowing users to choose environments that match their preferences. This debate has significant practical implications. Should platforms be required to allow all speech that would be legal in public, or should they maintain the ability to create more curated environments? The resolution of these questions shapes how platforms approach everything from political speech to harassment policies, and ultimately influences the nature of our online spaces. Public sentiment and policy discussions have increasingly shifted away from viewing platforms as purely private spaces and towards treating them as essential infrastructure for modern discourse. However, lawmakers' initial enthusiasm for imposing public square obligations on technology companies often collides with the complex realities of balancing competing rights and the practical implementation challenges. While it's relatively straightforward to declare that platforms should protect free expression, privacy, safety, and other fundamental rights, crafting frameworks that successfully balance these sometimes competing obligations has proved far more challenging. As a result, much of this decision-making is still left to technology companies. Noreen Fink, Executive Director of the Global Internet Forum to Counterterrorism, explains how this is managed with their members.
First, we do have a commitment to human rights and the UN Guiding Principles on Business on Human Rights as part of our membership criteria, and as is working with civil society. And so there is already a certain amount of willingness and kind of a wider aperture in terms of the lens of our member companies joining us and their willingness to engage in these conversations. So that is one very important aspect for us, that it's embedded in the membership criteria. We also foster a lot of expert discussions, proactive engagement. This year, for example, we hosted a discussion on sort of the meaningful application of human rights and some of these different perspectives and what that means for tech companies in their work. There's a blog post on our website. And so a lot of this is about awareness raising, engaging with tech companies, and sort of serving as a bridge between sometimes what may appear to be distant human rights conversations and then what it means in terms of practice, both for tech companies themselves, but also for wider counterterrorism efforts, because we know that what happens offline often relates very much to what we're seeing online. And so it's our role to bring that to tech companies. I do need to stress that we don't determine what they should or should not take off their platforms. We inform them what may be there and what content is harmful. And then it is for our member companies to act based on their own sort of terms and policies. So our job is very much in a sort of, dare I say, educational role to say, this is what's out there, this is what is on your platform, this is where you may have concerns, this is where you should have concerns, this is where we think that this kind of material really should be removed. But that decision about what, when, and how is removed is really up to each of the members.
The two rights that grab the headlines in this debate are privacy and freedom of speech, and we'll look at those in a moment, but for regulators and moderation teams, there are many other significant rights and freedoms that should be considered when making and enforcing rules and regulations, such as the right to association and assembly. Online platforms enable people to form communities and groups. Efforts to disrupt extremist networks can inadvertently impact legitimate political, religious, or social groups' ability to organize online. Religious freedom. Content moderation targeting extremist religious interpretations risks impacting legitimate religious discourse and practice, particularly for minority faiths. Access to information, the right to knowledge. Efforts to remove extremist content can sometimes result in the removal of important historical, educational, or journalistic content that documents extremism or conflicts. Due process rights. People whose content is removed or accounts suspended should have rights to appeal and seek redress, raising questions about transparency and accountability in content moderation. And digital inclusion or equal access. Security measures shouldn't disproportionately impact certain communities' ability to fully participate in digital spaces. David Shanks was Chief Censor for New Zealand from May 2017 to May 2022. He describes the challenge of balancing these various other rights against safety concerns.
Not long after I became Chief Censor, we had some extremist material sent through to us for classification that was very challenging in terms of the sorts of material we're talking about is people getting killed. One of the key challenges around this material, there's a number of challenges around this material as we got into assessing it. One is it wasn't obviously promotional or created by a terrorist organisation. It was a clip of something terrible happening to someone with no clear attribution to who was doing it or why. And this immediately cast us into the view of going, well, this is abhorrent, it's potentially traumatising for people to view, but if we make this unlawful to create or disseminate, what are the potential human rights or even evidentiary implications of that? Because some of this material could be used to condemn the acts being portrayed. Some of this material could be captured for the purpose of evidence or prosecuting wrongdoers.
In our digital age, the ability to investigate extremist activities often depends on accessing and analysing online data. But this immediately raises important questions about privacy rights. How much data should platforms and authorities be able to collect? What limits should exist on surveillance and monitoring? These aren't simple questions with easy answers. The ongoing debate around encryption perfectly illustrates this challenge. End-to-end encryption provides essential privacy protection for billions of legitimate users, from journalists protecting sources to businesses securing sensitive information to ordinary citizens having private conversations. But the same encryption can also shield extremist activities from detection. When authorities argue for backdoors to encryption, privacy advocates rightly point out that weakening encryption for one purpose weakens it for everyone. While tracking extremist networks might legitimately require analysing user data, we need robust safeguards to protect innocent users' information. This includes strict limits on data collection, clear rules about how long information can be kept, and strong protections against misuse of personal data. In the course of their work, intelligence services collect vast amounts of data. For the Inspector General of Intelligence Services, the focus is on how those intelligence agencies use and manage that data.
The issue for us is more about what the agencies ultimately do with that data. So it's, you're right, even open source intelligence is available to get huge amounts of data, huge amounts of information on individuals, groups. And my concerns are not so much with the gathering of the data, but it's more around what protections are put in place once they have that data. How is it being accessed and how is it being used? And I'm looking at the sort of lawfulness and propriety of those actions rather than wading through all the data. I'm making sure that there are proper policies and procedures in place to actually protect that as much as is necessary so that any accesses are necessary and proportionate to the functions of the agencies.
Freedom of expression is another vital consideration in this balancing act, but the arguments for what should be removed or protected because of it are often oversimplified, as David Shanks explains.
It's true. Censorship does impinge on free speech. There's no two ways about that, and there's no point in shying away from it. What I would constantly try to get people to understand, though, is that this isn't a binary. It's, you know, free speech isn't an absolute. There's always limitations on free speech. Even in the United States of America, which is arguably a high watermark for freedom of speech principles, there are limitations on freedom of speech there. There are things that you can go to jail or be prohibited from saying or expressing there, as there is in all countries. And so as soon as you realise that, you're realising, well, okay, so if there are limitations on free speech, and there are, there must be, then what are they? How do we apply them? And how do we manage that process to make sure that we're protecting freedom of speech as much as possible while being transparent about the rationales for limiting it and actually being effective on limiting harm? And so that just takes you to a balance conversation. What's the balance point between people's freedoms and freedoms of speech and freedoms to not be harmed, basically, is what we're talking about here.
In combating extremist content, we must be careful not to suppress legitimate speech. And this requires clear, consistent content removal criteria. What exactly constitutes extremist content? How do we distinguish between discussing extremism, which might be necessary for academic research or journalism, and promoting it? Appeals processes are crucial here. If content or accounts are removed, users need ways to challenge those decisions. These processes must be accessible, transparent, and fair. We've seen cases where legitimate content about countering extremism gets caught in automated filters, or where journalists reporting extremism have their content removed. Without robust appeals processes, these mistakes can't be corrected. Protected speech considerations are particularly important. Academic researchers need to be able to study extremist movements. Journalists need to be able to report on these issues. Civil society groups need to be able to discuss and debate responses to extremism. Our response mechanisms need to protect these legitimate activities while still targeting genuine extremist content. For the intelligence services in New Zealand, a requirement to respect freedom of expression is contained in their empowering legislation and monitored by the Inspector General of Intelligence Services. Brendan Horsley explains.
We do, and so do the agencies. They're required to. Section 19 of the Intelligence and Security Act requires the agencies to actually not impinge upon freedom of expression unless it fits within one of their functions. So it's sort of an explicit way of saying you've got to be careful in this area that you're not overstepping the mark and actually causing people who are genuinely protesting, genuinely expressing views, albeit ones that we might find difficult to stomach, but it's only when they're moving into that area of violent extremism or matters of national security that the agency should be involved. And so there's like a little check at the start that basically says, hey, is this just people mouthing off about stuff that we don't really find that sort of palatable, or is it mouthing off about stuff that actually is of national security interest? And if it is, then it's genuinely within the bailiwick of the agencies.
Although Horsley doesn't want to overstate the strength of that protection.
It's not a high hurdle to get over, but it is at least something that is considered.
A key component in balancing safety interventions against other rights are oversight mechanisms. The systems and organisations we use to ensure all of these balancing acts are being handled appropriately. These operate at multiple levels and serve different but complementary functions. The Christchurch Call seeks to eliminate extremist and terrorist content online, but respecting and protecting human rights was included as one of the core principles of the call, as explained by the Christchurch Call Foundation's CEO, Paul Ash.
Now, the flip side of that you've identified is a risk that governments may overreach, that they may look to use work on this in ways that are inimical to the free, open and secure internet or the enjoyment of human rights by folk who use the online environment. And we've set some quite high bars for that in the call. If you're looking to join the call, you commit to the fact that all actions under the call have to be consistent with international human rights law and with the principles of a free, open and secure internet. And that text is there deliberately. to try and protect for that issue.
Similarly, companies wishing to join the Global Internet Forum to Counter Terrorism, the GIFCT, are required to meet human rights and transparency commitments, as explained by Dr. Erin Saltman, Director of Membership and Programs for GIFCT.
We have a robust way of reviewing companies and bringing them in. It does mean that if you are an adversarial company, you're probably not going to apply to join us. And it does mean if you aren't willing to make a commitment to human rights or have transparency, you don't meet the criteria to join us. And it is amazing, one, to see how many companies have built their first transparency report or created human rights language for their platform just to join a counterterrorism effort. That's incredible to see. I think even last year, something like 8 to 11 of our companies updated their human rights statements in line with how we were progressing our own view of human rights and counterterrorism approaches.
At the platform level, independent review boards can play a crucial role. These boards, made up of experts from various fields, help ensure that content moderation policies and practices are fair and appropriate. They can review difficult cases and help establish precedents for future decisions. Government agency oversight is particularly critical when it comes to national security and law enforcement activities online. Democratic nations typically establish independent oversight bodies with statutory powers to monitor intelligence and security agencies. These oversight bodies ensure agencies operate within their legal frameworks, particularly regarding surveillance and data collection. Their role includes reviewing warrants, investigating complaints, and ensuring activities are both lawful and proportionate. The effectiveness of these oversight bodies depends on several key factors, including statutory independence and strong investigative powers, direct access to agency systems and information, the ability to receive and investigate public complaints, powers to require testimony and evidence, clear reporting channels to government leadership, and adequate resourcing and expertise. Brendan Horsley explains how an oversight body, such as the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security Services, can be effective in the face of an obvious resource imbalance between the office and the agencies it oversees.
On the face of it, compared with hundreds of staff at the two intelligence agencies, that does look as though we're under-resourced. But I think one of the things that sort of counter that balance is that we have access into the agency systems. We're able to conduct our own research independently of the agencies themselves. And there is, within the agencies, compliance units that report compliance incidents to us as well. And when we are conducting inquiries or reviews, we can ask the agencies to assist, to provide documentation, to even give evidence. I have the same powers as a commission of inquiry. I can require anybody, in fact, to be summoned before me to give evidence on oath, to produce documents and the like. So there's a lot of tools at my disposal to enable oversight to happen effectively. And if there was, for instance, a deliberate hindering of that process, which there isn't, by the way, I have that ability to report into the minister or to the prime minister, and effectively I would expect assistance to be obtained through those measures as well.
But he notes this isn't the case everywhere in the world.
There are agencies who are responsible for oversight but actually don't have the same degree of independence, the statutory independence. They don't have the same level of funding, and they're largely constricted by either resources or by an inability to commence their own inquiries and to actually delve into things.
Transparency reporting has become increasingly important across both private and public sectors. Major platforms now regularly publish reports about content removal, government's requests for information, and their enforcement actions. And government oversight bodies also aim to maintain public transparency while balancing national security considerations. This often requires careful judgment about what can be safely disclosed to the public while maintaining operational security. Angus Lindsay, lead advisor for the Violent Extremism Team at the New Zealand Department of Internal Affairs, explains their transparency report and its objectives.
Yeah, so we've published the Digital Violent Extremism Transparency Report for all 3 years that the unit has been in existence, and we're currently working on the 2024 report. The purpose of our transparency reports are essentially to tell the story of our mahi and to give the public confidence that we are balancing our statutory obligations to investigate illegal behavior and to protect freedom of expression and our political and civil rights. We've really closely followed guidance from NGOs such as Tech Against Terrorism on what should be reported on in our transparency reporting, and our reports have been reviewed by them and are considered as going above and beyond the industry gold standard for transparency reporting. And I think just more broadly, it's just, like you mentioned these earlier, these topics are sensitive and we are, in effect, censoring illegal or objectionable speech or content. And we need to be sure and clear with the public that we are not concerned about what you're saying if it does not meet that threshold of objectionable. So we're trying to be really clear and open with the public there. And just another way to inform the public that we about the work we're doing.
Transparency and public reporting are also critical tools for achieving the objectives of the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security Services.
My starting point is that I will try and put out a public report, even if it does have to be heavily redacted. I think that's really important. It provides the public with assurance that I have at least looked into an issue and either I have or have not found problems with the activities of the agencies, and I can then at least provide that assurance that either matters have been improved upon or they're actually okay already.
There are, of course, classified investigations undertaken by the Inspector General that are not made public.
There are plenty of those, unfortunately. Well, I say unfortunately, they do end up in the hands of the agencies themselves. I make recommendations and I'll report on whether the agencies have accepted my recommendations for improvement or not, and I always send those classified reports to the minister responsible for the agencies, so she is aware of where I might have had concerns about agency activities that I can't fully elaborate on publicly.
David Shanks notes how the challenge for accountability of not knowing what we don't know extends to much of the content removal and censorship process.
The safeguards there are essentially rights of review, transparency around process, and rule of law in terms of beyond the classification board review, people can obviously go to the courts and can and do go to the courts for review. So those things are all there. They're good, they're robust, they're natural parts of a robust and fair regulatory process. But I would say in addition to that, that this sort of area is an inherently difficult one in that often people can't see or read the material that you've classified as objectionable. So, you know, there's some opacity there and some things there that make it difficult to be as transparent as I would like about some aspects of this. There's no easy way around that other than thinking through your engagement processes and how you think about what you're doing.
One of those processes is to allow banned content to be accessed for specific purposes and by specific people or groups. David Shanks explains how this was incorporated into the communications about the decision to make the Christchurch attacks live stream and manifesto objectionable.
That was something that we emphasised in the public commentary in my interviews at the time when I was quite overt about the classification and the reasons for it and being open to, you know, having a discussion around that. The point we really put forward was the fact that we understood that actually there was potentially things to be learned from all of this material and that this decision did not prevent journalists, authors, researchers, experts from having access to it for legitimate reasons.
Civil society involvement provides another crucial layer of oversight. Having independent organisations and experts involved in developing and monitoring these systems helps ensure different perspectives are considered. This includes engagement with communities that may feel particularly impacted by surveillance or the content moderation practices. Technology presents ongoing challenges for oversight mechanisms. Issues include managing and protecting increasingly large data sets, overseeing the use of artificial intelligence and automated systems, keeping pace with evolving online threats, balancing security needs with privacy and civil liberties, and monitoring cross-platform and international activities. International cooperation and oversight has become increasingly important. Oversight bodies across different countries collaborate to share best practice, address common challenges, develop consistent approaches to new technologies, coordinate on cross-border issues, and build capacity in emerging oversight bodies. The Inspector General explains the international networks that his office collaborates with.
We're part of the Five Eyes Intelligence Oversight Review Council. So that's my equivalent bodies in Australia, the UK, Canada, and the US. We meet sort of virtually, I'd say, half a dozen times a year, and we have an annual conference as well. And it's mostly at an unclassified level, so we're not necessarily, well, we're not sharing each other's country's secrets with each other, but we are certainly talking about common problems that we've got, risks for oversight, risks for the agencies, and where we should be focusing our attentions. So that's a really useful body that, you know, I think I might have mentioned before, oversight can be a lonely business, and it's great to be able to talk to other people in that oversight world and see the commonality of problems that you have. There are varying sort of groups of oversight bodies that have an overlap with the intelligence agencies or are interested in intelligence, and the Europeans in particular have very strong oversight of their intelligence agencies. Later this year, I'm talking with the Norwegians, they're a similar size organization, similar size country, and believe it or not, have similar issues around, you know, statutory interpretation, the powers that agencies have, etc. So I'll be talking to the Norwegians again about some of the common issues that we've got.
Public accountability remains the foundation of effective oversight. The public needs to understand how these systems work, what protections exist, and how they can engage with these processes. This includes clear mechanisms for filing complaints, accessing public reports, understanding oversight findings, and engaging in policy discussions, as well as contributing to ongoing improvement of oversight mechanisms. For the Chief Censor in New Zealand, that oversight is provided by a board of review. David Shanks explains how his decision to find the Christchurch attackers' livestream and manifesto objectionable were tested and ultimately upheld by that board.
It is interesting to reflect on that. Yes, we did make the assessment on the livestream video very, very quickly. The manifesto took a bit longer because you're talking about a nearly 200-page document and a more difficult assessment in terms of what sort of harm to the public that kind of terrorist promotional publication might present. So that did take us a little bit longer. But in both cases, I knew the decision would be reviewed, and in fact, both the classification of the live stream and the classification of the manifesto went to the Board of Review, which is the review body that sits over the Chief Censor and the Classification Office. I don't want to put too much of my after-the-fact personal perspectives on the merits of the review applications, but I mean, the decisions were upheld by the board. And there were some very interesting submissions and points of view around the manifesto in particular, essentially saying that this was a document that represented freedom of political speech, for example, which is the sort of approach that can validly be raised in all sorts of documentation and manifestos and perspectives. I guess in terms of the decision on that document, it had all the same hallmarks that we had found in the likes of the Al-Qaeda and ISIS material that I'd mentioned before that had already been found objectionable, which was it was promoting terrorist violence, it was promoting killings, it was identifying targets, and it was specifying the rationale for people to to carry out killings in the name of a particular ideology. And this was absolutely the functional equivalent of those sorts of documents that we had previously found objectionable. So when journalists, for example, said to me, well, you know, how can you cut across our freedom of speech with respect to, you know, our rights to read this document to understand the intentions of this killer? My response was effectively quite similar. Look, this is the same as ISIS terrorist publications that we have previously found unlawful. And so if you're going to say that this is lawful, then you have to say that that sort of material is also lawful and think through what the implications of that will be.
What makes all of this particularly challenging is that the landscape is constantly changing. New technologies create new privacy concerns, new forms of expression challenge our content moderation frameworks, new threats require new responses, which in turn need new oversight mechanisms. And success in this space really isn't about finding the perfect solution. It's about maintaining a dynamic balance that protects both safety and rights. It requires ongoing dialogue between platforms, governments, civil society groups, and the public, and it demands constant evaluation and adjustment of our approaches. This podcast was produced by the Online Safety Exchange with support from the New Zealand Preventing and Countering Violent Extremism Fund. For more podcasts and for further information on the Online Safety Exchange and the OSX Network for Online Safety Practitioners, visit our website at onlinesafetyexchange.org.